Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, I find myself thinking a lot about equality and equity lately. Equity, not just in healthcare, but in all aspects of social contract in this country and the basic rights that should be afforded all citizens. You know, there was a recent report in the Washington Post which revealed a very alarming statistic. More than half of America's school children now live in poverty.
Well, alarming, Mark, and I have to say I found it shocking. What a telling report. More than 50% of America's children, pre-K through 12th grade, require some kind of food assistance every day. It's an important benchmark because it allows us to understand the challenges that so many of these young learners and their families face that go far beyond the classroom, but really have a direct impact on what happens in the classroom, outside the classroom, and on their future opportunities down the road. 50%.
50%. This shift to a majority poor student population is already leading to a widening gap between those students who are able to excel and achieve and those who fail to do so. We've seen it in our own community, and we've learned how much we can do to improve the situation at a local level with our full-service school-based health centers. And so school-based health centers for children that we serve, this is the first real interaction with primary care, behavioral health, and dental services.
But, you know, speaking of the school-based health centers, it is so exciting to see these children become more health literate, being little consumers of healthcare in a really wise way. It's also Give Kids a Smile Month around the country, and at the community health center, we've been providing free dental cleaning, screenings, and full restorative care to hundreds of children, mostly low-income and uninsured children. The Affordable Care Act has helped to close the gap, but it just doesn't address all of these threats to overall health, including chronic hunger and poverty.
As a nation, we must do more to protect our nation's greatest asset, the future generation. Equal access to health care, nutritious food, safe drinking water, all imperatives if we're to succeed.
But our guest today is somebody who's also concerned with equity and equal access. Dr. C. Michael Gibson is a Harvard-based cardiologist, and he's also founder and chairman of the board of the WikiDoc Foundation. His goal, make all the world's medical textbooks available for free online so that everyone in pursuit of higher medical learning can have access to the knowledge that's out there. Very ambitious project.
We're looking forward to that conversation. Margaret Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, also stops by. But no matter what the topic is, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at CHC Radio. We love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. C. Michael Gibson, the founder of the WikiDoc Foundation, in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. After almost a year of waiting, the Senate has finally confirmed the president's nominee to run the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Robert Califf, a cardiologist and longtime researcher at Duke University, joined the FDA a year ago and was selected to replace outgoing FDA Chief Margaret Hamburg. Opposition came from both sides of the aisle, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who felt his ties to the pharmaceutical companies who funded Duke research would keep him from being impartial, and that a new culture was required at the FDA. Dr. Califf has vowed to support good science and drugs and devices that work. The announcement came on the heels of the president's Precision Medicine Summit at the White House. Representatives from the NIH and research institutions, patient entities from around the country, joining forces to accelerate the pace of precision medicine, utilizing the power of personal genomics. The Precision Medicine Initiative seeks to have at least 80,000 participants sign on by the end of 2016 to make their genomic information, their health status, and other personalized information available for biobanking and broader research. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, and National Institutes of Health all joined forces on the expanding Zika pandemic, now listed in over 30 countries in South and Central America and the Caribbean. Recent data on pregnant American women who became infected with Zika while traveling to the region, of the 9 known cases, 2 had miscarriages, and 1 baby was born with microcephaly, the birth defect linked to the Zika virus. A Florida court has upheld the state's waiting period for women seeking to have an abortion. The appellate court upheld the state's contested 24-hour waiting period before a woman would be allowed to end a pregnancy. A law passed by the Republican-controlled legislature last spring required women seeking abortions in Florida to make two visits to a clinic with a mandatory 24-hour waiting period between. Many states have adopted such laws as conservatives seek to chip away at the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. And the Cleveland Clinic has just successfully performed the first uterine transplant in the U.S. The 9-hour surgery done on a 26-year-old patient. A Swedish woman gave birth earlier last year after being the first successful recipient of a donated uterus. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. C. Michael Gibson, founder and chairman of the board of the nonprofit WikiDoc Foundation and the world's largest open source textbook of medicine. Dr. Gibson is an interventional cardiologist and researcher who served as director of the coronary care unit at Beth Israel Hospital at Harvard Medical School, where he's also a professor. He's currently a full-time interventional cardiologist and chief of clinical research in the cardiovascular division at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's also earned numerous awards and distinctions, including being named one of America's top doctors by U.S. News & World Report. He received his B.S., M.S., and M.D. from the University of Chicago. Dr. Gibson, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on the show today.
Yeah. You know, we have a saying at our organization that healthcare is a right and not a privilege. And as founder of WikiDoc, you seem to be saying that access to medical education is a right and not a privilege. And can you tell our listeners about the origin of this idea and why it's so important to improve access to medical information?
I think you're right. In a TED Talk, I think I stated something similar, that really access to up-to-date medical education and content should also be a right. But unfortunately, so much of that information is cloistered away or hidden away behind paywalls so that only those who can pay can access the information. If you have something that could help someone with a life-threatening condition, why wouldn't you be willing to share it for free? So, in the United States, I think we have the perception that many healthcare providers are very well paid. That's certainly not the case around the world. Mm-hmm. There are countries out there where a physician makes maybe $100 a month, and the cost of access on the computer is, say, $500 a year. So they're really locked out of getting up-to-date medical information. So we do serve an international audience, and one of our goals is to assure that not just the U.S., but developing mm-hmm. countries also have access to the same kinds of information. Many young people who want to become doctors have to pay $1,500 for a few months of access to questions to help them prepare mm-hmm. for those tests that allow them to qualify to become a doctor. And so we want to make sure both patients and doctors and trainees, all of them have unfettered access mm-hmm. to critical information.
It seems inevitable almost that you'll come up against some powerful forces and companies that have proprietary control over medical textbooks and research articles and the like. And I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about what you've called your copyleft approach to gathering and disseminating all of this information written by others to counter the copyright infringement or potential infringement issues. How have you been able to bypass that on WikiDoc, and what are some of the challenges that you're running into?
Copyleft is not a term that I invented. It really is a true legal term, just like copyright.
Interesting.
Copyright began when we had the printing press. Suddenly you could make many thousands of copies of something. And the king became very nervous that, oh my gosh, what if someone says something bad about the king? Now they have a way to distribute it very rapidly. And they decided they needed to give people the right to copy. That's why it's called copyright. Well, after a while, Parliament convinced the King of England, for instance, that, you know, you got to kind of loosen up on the censorship. And still, until recently, the people who owned the printing press owned the content. Well, now that we're in the internet age, and now that the cost storing it is pennies and the cost of distribution is negligible, the issue of ownership really becomes moot. And we now have very easy ways to distribute the content, as you've heard, to millions of people very simply and freely. And the copyleft doctrine says this: you're able to share that content and put it on other sites or to distribute it. That's the whole goal. As long as you give attribution to the person who originally created the content. Seeing how angry I'm making everyone, I think I must be on the right path.
You're doing a great job.
Good measure.
You know, Margaret mentioned that the rapidly changing medical knowledge. I know Wikipedia works on sort of an open source participation, and I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how you managed to do this open source editing on over 160,000 pages that you have on Wikidoc, but illuminate us on how all of this gets managed.
Yeah, we do have some bidirectional flow of content between us and Wikipedia. I think our aims are a little different. Wikipedia is more of a general information source. Sometimes it's a little too complicated for patients, mm-hmm. and that's why we branched out to have WikiPatient, which is written at an eighth grade level for patients. And then we have WikiDoc, which is for doctors, which is written at least at the level of a generalist, if not a specialist. But, for instance, with one disease, it may have, I don't know, 15 to 20 chapters. So, you know, we talk about the pathophysiology as a chapter, the diagnosis, the treatment. You see how one disease can get multiplied into 15 to 20 micro chapters. And we divided it up that way. So if you want to go straight to the diagnostic section, you go there. You don't have to fumble through everything to kind of find that area. Many thousands of those are drugs. And what we've done is we've assembled a team of 20 people who just wrapped up the project of going to the FDA labels, creating the content straight from verified, credible information. But we went straight to the source to make sure we had the most credible information for doctors. We also have content from the National Library of Medicine written at the eighth grade level for patients. And drugs are one of the most widely looked up things. And so we've made a lot of effort to make sure we have very credible drug content. On the disease side, I kind of divide the world into two phases. The first phase is kind of building the Eiffel Tower, and the second phase is painting it repeatedly. You know, the structure of the Eiffel Tower never changes, but, you know, like the Golden Gate Bridge, it's always being repainted. And we're getting to the point where we've created the Eiffel Tower. Our goal is to create and work with some philanthropers to fund, you know, world experts and those around them to keep the content green or updated. You know, the sounds of heart murmurs are never going to change. The treatment, though, may change every few years. And what we need is a group of people to, you know, watch over the medical literature and all these different subspecialties and keep it green. So we're about to complete the base content. It's taken 10 years. We've had a 100 full-time, they do nothing but work on this, full-time volunteers working with me here in Boston, people making a million edits of the content over those 10 years. I personally made 80,000 edits to the site. I meet with the team every single morning. We review everything that every single person is working on. And we have a pretty intense process of scrutiny. So, you know, that's how we do all that we can to assure that the content is accurate. But the ultimate peer review is, you know, an international audience.
Sure.
You know, and if they find errors, they write to us and, and we rapidly correct it.
Perfect.
Well, you know, we've talked about the democratization of the medical information and the democratization of access. So the next, I guess, area of democratization is medical education itself. Clearly, you know, there are efforts underway to address a need to educate more healthcare providers, and that's not just around the globe, but here in the U.S. Can you share your vision for Wikidoc and its role in this larger picture? And how you think this might disrupt in an innovative way the status quo for both medical education and also even the continuing medical education units that all healthcare professionals are required to maintain over time.
Doctors learn by looking things up. They learn a little bit by sitting in classrooms, but I think the main way you learn is when you have a problem, mm-hmm. you go and you search and you look up everything related to that problem. We want to give doctors credit for the time that they're spending researching and learning, what we call micro CME or micro continuing uh-huh. medical education. And, you know, rather than saying, I spent 1 hour in some classroom, rather than that, why not give someone 1 minute and 13 seconds of unbelievably intense, you know, time that they're looking something up and learning as credit? And you build a bank where you say, you know, Dr. Smith got 1 hour and 13 seconds today, 3 minutes, 43 seconds tomorrow looking up topics. And that's how you measure a doctor's engagement in the continuing education process. So we've embarked on that with some collaborations that we are about to sign with some major medical institutions to offer that kind of credit. So we hope to shift away from CME to micro CME. Mm-hmm. Obviously, on the larger issue of education, kind of massive online educational efforts are gaining a lot of momentum. And both my sons attended MIT. I know a lot of the content mm-hmm. you can get for free at MIT. I often wonder, did either of them ever go to class? Watch online.
Micro class.
Yeah, you know, micro class, I guess. I think you'll see a growing movement in that regard. We want to play a central role in being the repository of all that educational content. But I do think what you'll end up paying for in the future is more the piece of paper, the certificate, whereas hopefully the true content, the content itself, will hopefully be free.
We're speaking today with Dr. C. Michael Gibson, founder and chairman of the board of the nonprofit WikiDoc Foundation, the world's largest open source textbook of medicine. Dr. Gibson served as the director of the coronary care unit at Beth Israel Hospital at Harvard Medical School, where he's also a professor. Let's just take a look at some of the research being conducted in new ways. And not only in your field in cardiology, but also across the spectrum, we're seeing the rises in things like patients like me and smart patients and the Apple new research kit. And you've been conducting longitudinal studies on cardiac protocol in multiple countries around the world. What kind of potential do you see from this increase in patient engagement and new and improved data sharing technologies?
Well, I think the potential is massive. Sadly, every time we do one of these trials that I lead at, say, 800 centers around the world, we have to redesign the whole thing. We have to start all over again. We have to create a database, and, you know, that costs $10,000 for every question that you want to ask, and it's millions of dollars just to design the study. The idea that we would be able to use the same infrastructure over and over and over again is very, very appealing because it's much more economical. And we do have these registries in different societies where the data is already being entered, so we can tap into it. All we need to do is then randomize someone to one treatment or the other. I think the problem comes in where you begin to have issues surrounding governance. You know, who owns this data? Who gets to decide, you know, what treatments people are randomized to? What's the role of the patient in deciding who's going to get randomized to what? So it's going to be an interesting conversation. Patients should be aware, with some of the smart devices and everything, that their information is going to be shared with others. They have to be comfortable with the privacy concerns that might arise. And then big data sounds very attractive, but unless you do research in a way where you're asking a question, where you're randomizing people by chance to one strategy or the other, it becomes very hard to make causal inferences about what's going mm-hmm. on. You can't just say, you know, people who on their app say they eat more dark chocolate have, you know, better outcomes than people who don't. that's not randomized, because the people eating dark chocolate may be completely different than the people not eating chocolate. I mean, I hate to pick on chocolate, but it's either chocolate, wine, coffee.
That's right.
You know, every week you see different results. And all this is because the research is very poorly done, because it's not being randomized. So big data doesn't mean that you get the right answer. You can have unbelievable certainty because of the numbers of people and reach the wrong conclusion. You know, my son works in genetics, in quantitative genetics, and the p-value, or the number of zeros that precedes that final number, has to be 50 digits before they reach a statistical conclusion, because they're doing so many tests. So great tool, but it's like a Ferrari. You got to know how to drive it.
Well, Dr. Gibson, you've been able to conduct hundreds of global studies, certainly with the support of the research community at Harvard, and also through your own research organization, Perfuse. Cardiovascular disease is a leading killer in this country and around the world. What, in your estimation, are some of the more exciting potential breakthroughs for treating cardiovascular disease?
Well, I've been really lucky to participate in some of the trials related to stents, you know, the things that pop the arteries open and keep them open, and the blood thinners, things that make your blood not clot. And that's been very rewarding over the past 20 to 30 years. We've improved mortality by about 30% with all that we do now compared to just 10 years ago. However, putting a stent in or going on a blood thinner is a little bit like putting your seatbelt on after you've had the car accident. You know, there's already a problem when you're having a stent put in. We need to back things up and prevent all these problems. There's a new class of drugs called the PCSK9 inhibitors, which dramatically lower your cholesterol levels down to the, 30 to 50 range, you know, bringing us back to where we were as hunter-gatherers. So lower bad cholesterol will be more and more achievable. On the other hand, I'm running a trial where we're actually going to be infusing real, true, human, good cholesterol. The good cholesterol is like the dump trucks that take away all the fat in your arteries. Well, we're going to be giving people good cholesterol, good garbage trucks, and see, you know, if we can improve their outcomes dramatically. And then heart failure, we often save many lives, and we have people living longer, but they're kind of the walking wounded. They are walking around with bad heart pumps, and that's another big area we need to work on.
Dr. Gibson, let's talk about a word that seems to come up quite a bit in your world, and that's collaboration. And you say in the old days, the credo in medicine was to publish or perish, and the new mantra is to collaborate or perish. And I want to say that's music to our ears. But tell our listeners how this new paradigm is altering the landscape in medical education, the practice of medicine in general, and perhaps most especially in accelerating the pace of research.
Well, it wasn't too long ago that things worked like this. You know, someone made an interesting observation, then they worked with industry to say, what if we made this mousetrap? What if we made this innovation? And the industry said, yes, let's do that. And at a single hospital, they would deploy that innovation like a stent. And the guy at the single hospital would publish his experience with that new technology. That is so 1990s. You know, we've moved from single center observation and trials now to multi-center and multinational trials, because the numbers of patients that are required to really show benefits at this point are very large, tens, twenties, thousands of patients. So in order to make, you know, bold claims, it requires a lot of bold data and a lot of big data, as we've just been talking about, from around the world. And, you know, if you're going to try and enroll 20,000 patients in a trial to answer a question, it takes a lot of collaboration.
We've been speaking today with Dr. C. Michael Gibson, interventional cardiologist, founder and chairman of WikiDoc, the world's largest open source textbook of medicine. You can learn more about his work by following him on Twitter at C. Michael Gibson or going to wikidoc.org. Dr. Gibson, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Did genetically modified mosquitoes cause the Zika virus outbreak in Brazil? No. Despite those rumors, GM mosquitoes may actually be able to help control the virus's spread. The Zika virus likely spread to Brazil around August 2014, and Brazilian authorities have estimated between 500,000 and about 1.5 million cases of Zika infection have occurred since then. The disease is spread by the Aedes mosquito, which also spreads dengue. To reduce Aedes mosquito populations and combat such viruses, a British biotech company called Oxitec genetically engineered Aedes mosquitoes, male Aedes mosquitoes, to produce offspring that die before they reach adulthood. This technique has been shown to reduce mosquito populations by 95% in some areas where Oxitec released the GM mosquitoes, and fewer mosquitoes mean less disease transmission. So where does the rumor come from that GM mosquitoes caused the Zika outbreak? It started with a Reddit contributor who posted to a subreddit geared toward conspiracies. The contributor claimed that the GM mosquitoes were released in the same area as Zika's epicenter. That's not true. Oxitec released its GM mosquitoes 400 miles away from Zika's epicenter, and the Aedes mosquito has a lifetime flight range of only a quarter of a mile. The Reddit contributor also claimed that some GM mosquito offspring still survive and pass on their genes, but only a small percentage survive, roughly 4% in the laboratory setting. It's unlikely that rate would hold in field conditions, plus only female mosquitoes bite people, transmitting the virus. The Reddit contributor then claimed that GM mosquito and Zika genes will mix, resulting in a supervirus that causes microcephaly, a sign of abnormal brain development. But there are no known ways for mosquito genes to infiltrate those of Zika. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Falling is a common experience among the elderly, and that is not good news.
If you're over 65 and you've fallen and broken your hip, 25% of them will die within 12 months. Another 25% will never be able to live independently, and a full 75% will never regain full mobility.
That statistic got former airbag executive Drew Lucatos thinking, what if you could apply the technology used in airbags to create wearable devices that protect a person from the impact of falling?
So, similar to the auto industry, our government has spent billions in about two decades on fall prevention programs for the elderly. What I'm suggesting is we make that same strategic shift that the auto industry did, and we begin focusing on intelligent protection of our elderly.
So they did their research and found a combination of accelerometers and other sensors on the band worn around the waist could deploy within 6 milliseconds of sensing an imminent fall, and protective bags unfurl around the hip joints before impact with the floor.
With the right technology, we can ensure that these people that meet that inevitable immovable object, which is the floor, can not only survive that accident, they can walk away.
He founded Active Protect Technologies, and while his initial focus was providing a significant barrier to devastating injury in adults, he has additional potential markets as well.
With this type of technology, we can protect against concussions. We can now protect Coumadin patients We can protect our military soldiers from IEDs.
A simple retooling of airbag technology in a wearable device that could greatly reduce the devastation of hip fractures, leading to better health outcomes and better quality of life. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.